This is episode number 26 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, August 23rd, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito. In this special edition of the podcast, we took the show on the road to the recent PFF Aspen Summit. On the last day of the conference, we held one of our occasional Alcohol Liberation Front get-togethers, and we recorded some TLF contributors and other special guests. We start with TLF contributors Cord Blomquist of CEI, James Catuso of the Heritage Foundation, and yours truly, reacting to the keynote speech by Google CEO Eric Schmidt.
But he's coming into a crowd that he knows is hostile towards him on the issue of the 700 megahertz issue, net neutrality. But are we hostile towards him on antitrust issues, specifically DoubleClick? Are we hostile towards him on security policies, data retention, privacy mandates? No.
And I would say that even about half the audience, I would like to think, are sympathetic to him on Google Books, for example.
Yeah, as a fair use thing. But why did he come and tell us things like, hey, did you know that the internet's very innovative? Well, thank you. We all actually work in technology policy. We have a fairly good understanding. I read the Wired magazine. I realize that there are... Have you heard of Second Life, Eric? I don't know. You know, it seems like he was saying a lot of obvious things to us.
I didn't know the internet was innovative. And this whole Google thing, being able to search, this was news to me. And I think it's a wonderful thing. I think he came out and he really did seem to be wanting to reach out to make bridges with what he knew was going to be if not a hostile audience, an audience that disagrees with him on some basic things. The question I have is, there seemed to be a number of questions where he was implying major changes in what Google's public policy positions had been. And I don't know whether he misstated what he meant to say and opened up the door to things he did not mean to open up the door to, or whether it was an intentional change of position.
Like the net neutrality position that he talked about, that net neutrality is something that we use when there's not sufficient competition, which is not what Google has said in the past, is that net neutrality is a founding principle of the internet, not that it's a supplement to a lack of competition.
And Jeff Eisenek, who hopefully we'll talk to later, you know, pressed him on that, because he said at one point that if you have 3 to 4 competitors, that's more than enough to obviate any need for net neutrality. And Jeff told him, we've got 3 to 4 competitors, and what...
That's probably the first time they put a number on it, now that I think about it. Three or four, now we have a goal. And we've met it in wireless, by the way. The idea that net neutrality is conditioned on competition is exactly what Andrew McLaughlin said last February. And that caused quite a stir and back and forth among a lot of Google's allies. And they eventually came out and said that there was no change in Google's prior position. And the idea was dropped, but this indicates that it's still, at least at CEO level, that's the prevailing thought.
Well, if that's genuinely Google's policy position, which I don't think it is, I think that they advocate nationwide net neutrality on all networks. Because if they really advocated that, why wouldn't they be advocating franchise reform? Why wouldn't they be advocating that we open up networks to more competitors? But they haven't come out with any sort of policy recommendation on that, saying let's open things up to more competition. They only want this, essentially, a bad policy making up for other bad policies on state and local levels.
Well, and if you want to be a cynic about it, what might explain that on the 700 megahertz level is that if you have these policies on this chunk of spectrum, the value goes down to a price where they can bid on it, and then 2 years later, ask for a waiver and get it.
Well, and if Eric really wants his 50 megabits per second everywhere, he's either got to advocate tremendous government supplements or subsidies of it, or he's got to back away from this position, because it occurs to me that all that they're advocating is continuing to devalue the role of network industries to the point where they're just public utilities. They don't have any reason to innovate or press out. They can't tie themselves to devices. They can't sign exclusivity deals with applications. That he's cutting off so many pathways towards investment and innovation, there's nothing left for these guys.
Although at the same time, he seemed to be trying to limit that damage by saying that common carriage, if you have a common carriage system, it should be limited just to bit rates and allowing possibility of exclusive deals. He specifically said that the ISP should be able to provide value-added services. He didn't say prioritization, but he didn't exclude that either. He said they should be able to provide value-added services for a fee, which are major concessions. And if that is Google's policy, that's significant. I'd like to see it in writing.
Next, Jeff Eisenach of Criterion Economics tells us what he thinks of Schmidt's keynote, broadband competition, and the idea of an open access network. Along with Jeff, you'll hear TLF contributor Adam Thierer of PFF and yours truly again.
You know, I think Eric Schmidt's speech has got to remind somebody of what it felt like to be a liberal Democrat listening to Newt Gingrich in 1995. You knew he was wrong, you thought he was evil, and you were absolutely sure you were screwed.
But, you know, Eric Schmidt, I mean, we've had a lot of great speakers at Aspen through the years. I think back, Jeff Bezos, many other great leaders. I mean, how did this compare? I mean, Google's a force to be reckoned with out there now. You know, they're covering so many bases now. They're doing so many things. I mean, what from his remarks really impressed you or maybe didn't in terms of where Google's going as a company or what it means for the public policy debates they're engaged in?
You know, I think the short answer is that the set of arguments that Google and the New America Foundation and, you know, folks like that who I admire, have built is a very compelling set of arguments. I think it's ultimately an incorrect set of arguments. I don't think it respects property rights. I don't think it properly understands the need to allow people who invest in infrastructure to appropriate the rents from those investments. So when you get down into the nitty-gritty of the arguments, I think they're wrong. When you listen to the arguments coming from Eric Schmidt or from people making them, and you imagine how those arguments are going to be understood by policymakers relative to the arguments that property rights defenders are making today, I think they've constructed a dominant set of arguments. And I think we're on the defense and are going to be playing defense until we do better.
But let me ask you a question, one last follow-up on this, because do you think it's a case that maybe, as some suggested tonight in questioning Eric Schmidt, that Google in some ways might be digging its own grave by creating regulatory paradigms or frameworks that could come back to haunt them in the future? Clearly, the general principles around net neutrality could be applicable to other layers of the Internet, including that applications layer that they run in and the search environment. Do you think it could come back to haunt them in the future?
You know, I think potentially, but I think the arguments... ultimately, the arguments against regulating Google or regulating other software-focused industries come back to the question of barriers to entry. And there are network effects and there are other issues there, but it's very hard to make an argument, given that Google itself, you know, entered the market 5 years ago. It's very hard to argue that disruptive change can't come in and unseat that quote-unquote monopolist. What I find frustrating is Jim Barksdale testifying before the Senate Commerce Committee on behalf of Frontline, same group, that, you know, we have a Verizon singular duopoly in the cell phone business, which is just flat out untrue. And the question I asked of Eric Schmidt today was to try to sort of pin him down on that, and he was hard to pin down. On that. The fact of the matter is, if you do a competent competition policy analysis of competition in the wireline or wireless space, they're extraordinarily competitive industries in the same way that Eric Schmidt would argue that search is a competitive industry. And, you know, I don't think it's to our benefit to try to turn it around and argue that Google is a monopoly and needs to be regulated. I think we need to do a better job explaining why there's competition in the infrastructure space.
Jeff, to me, the most interesting thing that came out of his speech, or actually the question session, was his sort of admission that Google actually is seriously considering bidding on the spectrum and that it's probable. What do you think about that? What does that mean?
I hope they do, and I hope Verizon doesn't. And the reason for that is, I think it's very important to be technologically unbiased in how we think about these things. I think it is fascinating to imagine an edge-oriented as opposed to network-oriented service, broadband service, that is built on a fundamentally different business model that probably has vastly lower costs of network construction. And hence, sunk costs in building the network. Probably, I think, doesn't offer the same kind of secure, reliable services that the current CMRS services do, but may offer, a place where most of the time you can make a Skype call for free. I hope they go out and do that, and I think the technology, may well permit it, and if they do, it'll be really cool, and we all ought to applaud it. To the extent that they get a discount, if the value of that spectrum is $6 billion, and they bid 4.6, You know, that's $1.4 billion down the tube we shouldn't have spent. But I hope they go. But I hope, really hope they go build it. And I'm not biased. I think we ought to be optimistic about the possibility they can, and it'll be cool.
Right. So in essence, you're sort of agreeing with the FCC position. This is a great time to experiment. But my question is, why can't they experiment?
No, I think ultimately for the FCC to, where I think the FCC utterly failed here is to concede the principle that competition in the wireless space currently isn't adequate, and therefore intervention in any form is required. And so even though the intervention is, at the end of the day, the intervention is the difference between $4.6 billion and whatever the market cost of the spectrum was, right? That's the measure of what we just spent for this intervention. But whatever that amount is much less than the impact of conceding the larger point, which is wrong, which is there's inadequate competition and innovation in the wireless space, and therefore we need government intervention to create more. And under the Susan Ness FCC in 2009, that will come back to be a big problem for all of us. Kevin Martin will be frequently cited by the Ness FCC in this matter, and deservedly so.
Thank you.
Finally, TLF contributor Hans Haney of the Discovery Institute discusses Lawrence Tribe's address on the First Amendment and technology with Adam Thierer and me.
For example, Professor Lawrence Tribe from Harvard today was asked a question about whether or not broadband service providers could be forced to act like common carriers, and it was fascinating. He cited a case, a Supreme Court case, relating to the Boston Irish Parade as standing for the proposition that you couldn't force, you know, a conduit provider to carry a particular piece of content, and I never would have made the connection. But his conclusion was you can't force common carriers to carry certain kinds of content. So I thought that was very interesting.
And basically what he's saying is that by running a parade, you're exercising some editorial control over who gets to be in the parade. And if you don't want to allow certain floats, you know, you're not just a dumb pipe. You're exercising editorial control. The same goes for Comcast or anybody else like that.
Exactly. Yeah. I thought that was one of the most newsworthy moments of the conference.
Absolutely. Another point about what Lawrence Tribe said that I think is really important is that he made the point that if some of the old laws that are out there or the old statutes and cases that are out there dealing with free speech were challenged today in the courts, they would almost certainly be struck down, specifically the famous Pacifica Seven Dirty Words case. And I think a lot of people are starting to think that those cases are in real trouble, like Red Line and Pacifica. And Tribe basically said here today that there's no chance that those will survive constitutional scrutiny if tested again in front of the Supreme Court. This is a guy who's argued 37 cases in front of the Supreme Court. I think he probably has a pretty good feel for it, as well as the breakdown of how things would go in terms of votes. So I think that's a pretty newsworthy thing as well.
Well, that's it for this special edition of Tech Policy Weekly. Stay tuned for another Live from Aspen edition in a couple of weeks. To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes. And don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. See you next time.